And very tiny people, just a few inches tall, are the subject of a magical animated story, a movie that opens in theaters this weekend. Kenneth Turan has this review.
The Secret World of Arrietty is based on Mary Norton's celebrated 1952 novel, The Borrowers, about a race of tiny people who live amongst us but prefer to go unseen.
My mother, father, and I are all borrowers. We borrow things that beans won't miss if they're gone. Just little things, soap and cookies and sugar, all things that we need to survive.
That's 14-year-old Arrietty, voiced by Bridget Mendler. She's feisty and fearless, even though she's no taller than a teacup. But Arrietty gets into trouble when she accidentally allows a curious young boy to catch a glimpse of her.
What do they call you?
Not that it's any of your business, but it's Arrietty.
Arrietty? Could you at least come out so I can see you? I want to make sure I'm not dreaming.
This all seems innocent enough, but Arrietty's father knows that even well-meaning humans can cause terrible damage to borrowers. Japan's Hayao Miyazaki, the great animator of the modern age, has had the secret world of Arrietty on his mind for more than 40 years. He did not direct this version himself, but having planned and written the screenplay and handpicked the director, Miyazaki and his protective spirit hover over the production like a benevolent deity. One of the pleasures of this film is how splendidly detailed it's made this small, small world. Formidable planning is needed to use rope and duct tape to climb cabinets and raid a human kitchen. And the little people involved need to be part mountain climber and part Navy SEAL commando to have even a chance of success. What makes The Secret World of Arrietty transporting is its ability to create a marvelous world for audiences to lose themselves in. At the screening I attended, after the last frame disappeared from the screen, no one rushed to leave their seats. Everyone wanted to hold on to the magic Arrietty created for as long as possible.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. Lawmakers are expected to vote on a bill today that extends the payroll tax cut through the end of the year. In a Congress famous for pushing deals to the last minute, this one comes nearly 2 weeks before a deadline and appears to have bipartisan support. It extends the average $20 a week tax holiday to 160 million Americans and also extends benefits to those who don't have jobs. NPR Sonari Glinton has more.
If the plan passes, for those who have a job and have been getting a payroll tax cut, things will pretty much stay the same. They'll continue to get a payroll tax cut. The same thing for doctors who would have seen their Medicare reimbursement dramatically reduced. They'll get paid the same. What's different is for those approximately 4 million people who get unemployment insurance benefits. House Republican Kevin Brady of Texas helped work out the compromise on jobless benefits. He's going to help explain it. First, unemployment benefits are extended through the rest of the year.
But we gradually reduce them to about 63 weeks from 99 today in most states.
If the state has what's considered high unemployment, laid-off workers will keep their benefits for 73 weeks.
We require job search from day one, which is important.
And here comes one of the big controversial items.
We allow states to do drug testing, especially in those industries that require it.
So if the industry that you work in requires drug testing, you have to get tested. If you got let go for using drugs, you'd also have to take a test. Representative Brady says he sees the overall deal as a good opportunity to change how people get unemployment benefits.
We have basically a system from the 1930s we essentially still use today. Its whole goal is to send out an unemployment check. But we think the goal ought to be getting people back to work.
The plan also gives some states flexibility in how they use the money with the hope that they can design experimental programs that will help people find jobs. Maurice Insulum is with the National Employment Law Project. He says he's not happy with all the changes, but he thinks the program is too important to let lapse.
If it weren't for the unemployment benefits program and all these extensions, there's an excellent chance that we wouldn't have an economic recovery at this point.
Insulum says he doesn't want to see barriers put in front of people who need jobless benefits, but he says he doesn't think it's likely the majority of states will drug test applicants.
Most states, we anticipate, won't sign on to this program, partly because they also have to fund these drug tests. And unless there's a really good reason to drug test folks, which there really isn't, from the point of view of a lot of states, it's not going to make sense to to put resources into this drug testing effort.
Democrats have fought hard against many of the provisions that were just listed and won some concessions. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is encouraging Democrats to vote for the plan because she says it could have been worse.
It does not have these strange, like you have to have a high school diploma in order to get unemployment benefits.
When asked what she meant by strange, Leader Pelosi responded,
"Did I use the word strange?"
"I think you did."
"Well, whatever. Go on." Because strange is probably a good all-purpose word around here. I don't
Strange might also describe how quickly Congress resolved legislation so far ahead of a deadline, though it still has to pass over the objections of members of both parties. Because a last-minute snag, that wouldn't be so strange. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, the Capitol.
And keep stocking up on those forever stamps. If Congress acts on the recommendations of the Postmaster General, the price of a first-class stamp could go up to 50 cents. Patrick Donahue is urging lawmakers to consider major changes to the operations of the U.S. Postal Service, all part of a plan to save $22 billion a year. In a letter addressed to Congress, he calls for slashing 150,000 jobs, mostly through retirements. The most significant savings would come from a proposal to break away from the federal health benefits plan. The Postmaster General also wants to extend delivery time for long-distance mail. This comes on top of an expected end to Saturday delivery service. Without changes, Donahue projects the Postal Service will have annual losses of about $18 billion by 2015.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Much has been made of the surprise deal on Capitol Hill to extend a payroll tax holiday through the end of the year. But far less has been made of something else in that deal. It will avert a scheduled cut in Medicare payments to doctors. That cut was nearly 30%. But as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, the nation's doctors are more frustrated than relieved.
The good news for doctors and the millions of Medicare patients they care for is that assuming everything goes as planned, the 27.4% cut in reimbursement that would have taken effect March 1st won't. The bad news? The fix isn't permanent. It only goes until the end of the year. And then, if Congress doesn't act again, the cut will be in the neighborhood of 32%. That's leaving doctors in a continuing state of uncertainty.
Disgruntled is probably just too soft of a term for this. It's really devastating to try to run an office in this environment.
Robert Waugh is a reproductive endocrinologist and chairman of the board of the American Medical Association. He says doctors have been through this exercise before, waiting to see if Congress will stop a scheduled Medicare cut, too many times.
In 2010, Congress did this to us five times. There are five patches put in place, and a couple of times they actually waited till after the deadline.
Which meant payments were delayed. Waugh says many physicians are also small businesses, and the uncertainty of knowing how much, or in some cases whether they're going to be paid to see their Medicare patients, is more than just an inconvenience.
Because they have to continue to pay their rent and their insurance and their electric bill and the salaries of the people that work in their office.
Until now, the public hasn't had a lot of sympathy for the plight of America's doctors and their Medicare woes. Despite their complaints, doctors still earn a lot more than the average American, and surveys showed that most doctors continue to treat Medicare patients. This problem with how Medicare pays doctors is the result of a funding formula enacted in 1997 that's since gone awry. It affects many members of the military, too, because rates for the TRICARE health program are tied to those for Medicare. But over time, it has been gradually eroding what doctors earn to care for those patients. That's because while Congress mostly hasn't let the scheduled cuts take effect, it also hasn't given doctors a raise. The result, says Waugh,
there's now a 20% gap between the cost of taking care of the folks in the Medicare and TRICARE system and the lack of increase in our fee schedule.
And that's starting to have an impact on patients, says Paul Ginsberg. He heads the Center for Studying Health System Change, a health research think tank. Ginsberg says most Medicare patients aren't having trouble getting care because they're not changing doctors. But with many doctors not taking new Medicare patients, there is starting to be an access problem.
Someone who needs another doctor either because they've moved or their doctor is retired or they just don't like their doctor anymore. Those are the people bearing the brunt of whatever access limitation we have.
Ginsberg says he's also worried about something else, the increasing gap in pay between primary care doctors like family practitioners and internists and specialists, particularly now, he says.
We really are looking to primary care physicians to play a bigger role, to coordinate care, to manage chronic disease, and not just to do piecework. And at the same time as we're envisioning a changed role, we're making primary care much less attractive.
Those changes to the health delivery system are the result of the 2010 health overhaul, and it did include some payment increases for primary care doctors and Medicare. But it didn't fix the overall doctor payment problem, largely because it costs too much. And while there were a few hints that Congress might be ready to fix it using unspent funds from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that didn't happen, which is why Waugh and his colleagues are getting increasingly frustrated. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Thousands of objects hurtle around the Earth in space at high speed. Bits of defunct satellites and the rockets that launched them into orbit. In short, space junk. Well, now from Switzerland comes a solution to the problem of orbiting debris. The Swiss Space Center is working on a janitor satellite. Back in 2009, Switzerland launched its own Cube satellite. That's a very small satellite. And now, some might say, with characteristically Swiss attention to neatness, the Swiss intend to clean up after themselves. Dr. Anton Ivanov is a scientist at the Swiss Space Center, and he joins us now from Lausanne. Dr. Ivanov, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And I want you to describe for us what the janitor satellite, as it's been called, will actually do.
Well, first, after launch, we will have to target very precisely orbit of either SwissCube or TSAT. Then we will approach the satellite using a propulsion system. And then there will be a proximity operation where we will have to actually rendezvous with the satellite, grab it, and then deorbit it to burn in the atmosphere.
Now, the SwissCube satellite, when I said it's small, it's just a 4-inch square, essentially.
Exactly. It's a 4-inch square satellite. It follows what's known as the CubeSat standard, which was developed by Stanford University and Cal Poly University.
If this janitor satellite is going to be worth the effort, shouldn't it collect more than one 10-centimeter squared satellite?
Yes, absolutely. This particular mission that we're proposing is going to be a technology demonstration, and at the same time, it will achieve a certain mission to remove our own satellite. Besides, we can only go after two satellites that are there in orbit from Switzerland.
Because that's it for the Swiss satellite program, is it?
Yes. For the moment, yes. But then definitely we are thinking about systems that we will be able to collect more than one satellite and especially go after smaller debris and larger debris that are in orbit.
Now, there have been, I gather, just a couple of junk collisions in space that have been noteworthy. And there are, I gather, over 15,000 things up there orbiting. At what point does it become so crowded up there with junk that collisions really would be a danger to be avoided on a routine basis?
Well, this is known as a Kessler effect. And once you're getting more and more junk and random collisions in space, they will start to multiply exponentially. And at some point, all orbits will be so littered with junk that collisions will be almost permanent and we will not be able to fly operational satellites in low Earth orbits.
When somebody launches a satellite, do they have any obligation under the law or under treaties as they exist now to at some point clean up after themselves and figure out how the satellite is supposed to go away?
I know on the side of the European Space Agency is that now they are adopting policies that all of the satellites are supposed to be removed after 25 years. Now, for example, if we fly our SwissCube at an altitude of approximately 700 kilometers, it will take it more than 50 years to slow down significantly to re-enter Earth's atmosphere. And this is unacceptable by today's standards that are required by the European Space Agency.
Hence, the janitor.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Ivanov, thank you very much for talking with
us
today.
Thank you very much.
That's Anton Ivanov, who's a scientist at the Swiss Space Center. He spoke to us from Lausanne, Switzerland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. When the Chinese dissident writer Liu Xiaobo was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010, an empty chair took his place on stage in Oslo. That's because Liu is serving an 11-year prison sentence for what the Chinese government deemed incitement to subvert state power. And after the Nobel ceremony, if you searched for the phrase empty chair on the internet in China, you'd find nothing. Chinese censors had banned it. That gives some sense of how threatening this voice had become. That's Liu Xiaobo in 2006, urging writers around the world to support Chinese writers so they can change China from what he calls a totalitarian state into a free nation. Well, if that voice has been silenced, Liu's words have not. A collection of his essays and poems has just been published, and editor Perry Link joins me to talk about the book. It's called No Enemies, No Hatred. Professor Link, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about that title. It comes from the final statement that Liu Xiaobo read at his trial in 2009. What was his message to the court?
He was very taken by nonviolent philosophies of Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And Václav Havel was a hero of his. And he wanted to make the point that the crux of the matter is not bad people, it's a bad system that China's dealing with. So he went out of his way in this statement to say that all of the police that arrested me and the prosecutors who prosecuted me and the judges who sit before me today are not my personal enemies. It's the system that traps them and me that we have to attend to.
He also does pitch that message forward. And let's take a listen. We have a reading of some of the last words in that statement that he read in court.
I hope that I will be the last victim in China's long record of treating words as crimes. Free expression is the base of human rights, the root of human nature, and the mother of truth. To kill free speech is to insult human rights, to stifle human nature, and to suppress truth.
Those words from Liu Xiaobo. What's known, Perry Link, about the conditions in the prison where he's being held?
Very little. The last report that I have that I think is credible is from the China Human Rights Defenders, and this was from more than a year ago, who said that he is in a cell with five others. He has to eat the prison food. The other five are allowed to use their own funds to buy better food, but he is not. All six of them are allowed out in the courtyard 1 hour a day for exercise. But all of the above is not confirmed. It's my best guess, and the real answer is we don't know.
Now, in 1989, Liu Xiaobo was among the leaders of the pro-democracy movement in Tiananmen Square. He actually went back to Beijing from the United States to join in those protests, but he escaped the massacre. And it sounds like in a lot of these essays, he is plagued with survival guilt. Let's listen to a section of an essay that he wrote about this in 2003.
I was a participant in the 1989 movement and observed how, in that dark night and early dawn, it was sliced by bayonets, pierced by bullets, and crushed by tanks. The glinting tips of the bayonets still stab in the recesses of my memory. As one of the survivors, I see before my eyes two things: the souls of those who died for a free China, and the violence, the lies, and the bribery of the killers. And I am haunted by the grave responsibility of being still alive. I do my best to make every word from my pen a cry from the heart for the souls of the dead. I use my memory of their graves to combat the Chinese government's pressure to erase memory. My searing desire to atone for having survived helps me resist the temptations to join the world of lies.
Professor Link, how much do you think those ghosts from Tiananmen still shadow Liu Xiaobo more than 20 years after that massacre?
Haunted, I think, is the right word. One part of this guilt is that he's very, very hard on himself.
Mm-hmm.
At the massacre, after it, he negotiated a way out for the students who were remaining in the square, and that compromise, for which others have criticized him, probably saved a few dozen, if not a few hundred lives. But then he escaped to the diplomatic quarter and took refuge in the home of a foreign friend, and later felt terribly guilty about that, because later he learned that other, as he calls them, ordinary Chinese, stayed on the streets, tried to rescue the wounded, and sometimes paid themselves with their lives for doing so. So he's been very, very hard on himself for that point.
Mm. You know, as I read through these essays, I kept wondering what the boundary is of what is considered acceptable dissident speech in China, because these essays are often very tough, but they didn't all get him into trouble. What do you think it is that crossed the line with the authorities? What did they cite?
Well, at the trial, they listed the Charter 08, which was a pro-democracy manifesto published in December 2008, for which he was a main organizer. The Charter 08 is very broad in the themes that it addresses, about democracy, about the economy, about education, about the environment. The crucial part of Charter 08, in the view of the authorities in Beijing, was its call for an end to one-party rule. Liu Xiaobo does not call for an end to the Communist Party. His view is that, yes, you can compete with others, but the crucial point is that you need to compete with others, and other parties should be allowed to exist and operate. And the Communist Party of China can't swallow that.
Liu Xiaobo writes in one of these essays that China has a problem, that it doesn't have a moral leader. He mentions Václav Havel from the Czech Revolution, that China doesn't have a figure like that. Do you think he is that figure in some sense? How is he seen by the Chinese public?
He could be that kind of figure, but isn't yet, just because he isn't that well known in China. The reason he's not well known is that the government has been assiduous about repressing his works. And that, by the way, shows that the government authorities themselves are as clear as anybody on the fact that if Charter 08 and his other essays got out, they would have a tremendous positive reception. Before he won the Nobel Prize, his blogs that came back to China on the internet probably had readership of about 10 to 50,000, somewhere in there. When the Nobel Prize came, that news inevitably did leak out on the Chinese internet and spread widely. And suddenly websites that had to do with him were pummeled by inquiries from inside China about who is this man and how can we read more of him. He still isn't known as widely in China as he could be, and therefore isn't quite a Václav Havel in that same sense.
And assuming that Liu Xiaobo does serve his complete 11-year sentence, he'll be out of jail when?
In June of 2020.
Professor Link, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That's Professor Perry Link. He teaches at the University of California, Riverside, and he edited the collection of essays from Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo titled No Enemies, No Hatred. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're going to hear now from Planet Money, and we start with a reminder of the root of Europe's financial crisis. European countries borrowed too much money. That money has to be paid back, but in many cases, new money does not exist in Europe. Hannah Jaffe-Walt with our Planet Money team reports that this simple fact has European leaders on a global search for cash.
Here's where we are. The Europeans have tried bailout funds. They've hosted dozens of summits. At those summits, hatched plans for more bailout funds. The European Central Bank has gotten involved. And yet, investors are still afraid to lend money to European countries. The countries need money, and so it has come to this.
Chancellor Merkel came to our academy talking to our scholars.
This is Jiang Sushui. He's an academic at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, gleefully describing to me one of the most exciting moments of his 56 years as a Chinese person. The moment when one of the most important people in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, came to his country, to his workplace.
He said that the EU would be happy to see China can offer a kind of a helping hand for the EU.
She said she would like to see China offer a helping hand to the EU.
And
meaning
finally,
what? Meaning money?
Oh, yes, of course, money. Well, I would say her voice was gentle and her words were nice. And
well,
open,
you have to be friendly and gentle when you're asking somebody for money.
Yes.
Merkel never actually said the word money or help. Cooperation, that's a word she used a lot. But no matter. Jiang says everyone in that auditorium heard one clear message. Europe needs help from us.
I can't believe that China is now the country that the EU is trying to seek help from.
That the EU is seeking help from.
Yeah. 22 years ago, China was like really a basket case or a very poor developing country. And so I really feel quite proud.
Were you convinced by Chancellor Merkel?
Yes, I would say. Yes, why not?
Jiang says it makes sense for China to help Europe. Europe buys a lot of stuff from China. China needs a healthy Europe. And the Chinese government has expressed interest in increasing its investment in Europe. But it wants to make sure its money is as safe as possible. And that, right now, is a little complicated to pull off. Not to mention that it's a hard sell to the people of China. The average Chinese person, compared to the average European citizen, is dirt poor, makes on average about a sixth of what a Greek person makes in a year. Here's Yu Lian, a government civil servant in Beijing.
Yeah, if you talk to the layman on the streets, they will tell you that give the money to us instead of the foreigners.
Well, I mean, there's in some ways, it's actually less bizarre than you think.
This is Arvind Subramanian at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington.
The principle that a poorer country like China should be financing rich country governments, I mean, that's been happening for a very, very long time now. Remember, who is one of the biggest investors in U.S. Treasury bonds? It's China, right?
Subramanian says you can think of this as an extension of an already bizarre trend. Rich countries are relying on poor countries to finance the regular times, and now to get them through emergencies, too. Khana Jaffe-Waltz, NPR News.